Ever wonder what makes pandas so special? Join us on Amazing Wildlife to find out.
Giant pandas and their habitat are unique and beautiful and extraordinary representation of the natural world. And if you get that opportunity to sit and watch a panda eat bamboo, you will be mesmerized.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Amazing Wildlife and start listening.
I want to welcome Kevin Pham today. He's the writer of The Architects of Dignity, a new book. And we are starting a series, a sub-series of the Vietnamese podcast, and we're focusing on historical figures of Vietnamese political thinkers, historians, academics, anybody in sort of the space of Vietnamese history that have had an enormous amount of influence. And Kevin's specialty, because Kevin's been on the Vietnamese podcast twice already, is somebody who understands a lot of these figures. And I've asked Kevin to come on to speak about many of the figures that we are going to be talking about in the next few months. And the show is not too far. It's not too different than the Vietnamese podcast. The only difference is these people have passed away, and Kevin and I are going to be doing some talking about these people's lives. And the format is really Kevin as professor, Kenneth Nguyen as host and student of the people that we are going to talk about. So welcome to the Vietnamese podcast with Kevin Pham and Kenneth Nguyen today.
Thanks, Kenneth, for having me again. When you brought this idea up to me, I was so excited. I think it's so important, especially for young Vietnamese people, especially young Vietnamese Americans like myself, to learn about Vietnamese history through the lens of different figures, influential figures. You know, we grew up, we hear names. Who were these people? What were their lives like? What problems in history were they responding to? So I'm really excited for this episode.
But here's where there's going to be a little bit of an issue. And I want to bring this up in the beginning. Since this is our first episode together, I was at a dinner party over the weekend and I ran my mouth. I was unhinged about how I felt about the way the different communities throughout the Vietnamese universe, how they view each other. I'm torn. I am torn with the first generation diaspora, second generation. I'm torn with some segments of people in Vietnam, a lot of things that the Vietnamese government does, as well as, you know, the U.S. government and the new elections cycle that we just experienced. I'm torn, and I really became unhinged. And so it really kind of made me think about what I needed to say before we start this journey together, Kevin, which is, our journey of exploration is to look at things from all sides, at figures from all sides. Some of it may hurt one community. Another detail might be damaging to another community. But I think I want to exercise this power of nuanced conversation. And this is where I want it to begin.
Yeah. And just to go off of that, one approach that I'm going to take in each of these episodes is to do two things for each figure. I'm going to be as sympathetic and critical as I can be. So it's those two moves. I'm going to look at them sympathetically, but also critically. And I think that's what a good scholar should do.
Because some of these figures will be, really pro-South Vietnam's government before 1975, and others will be deeply part of the new government's historical figures. And I think that all of it is fair game if we really want to challenge this idea of not being able to communicate freely in our different Vietnamese communities around the world.
Yeah, great. So do you mind if I start with a few caveats?
Yes, please.
So I'll say this once in this episode, so hopefully listeners will keep that in mind for the rest of the episodes. So just to get a few things out of the way, I'm a scholar of Vietnamese intellectual history. My specialty is political theory. I'm not a historian, but I do specialize on Vietnamese political thought during the French colonial period. And I've written several peer-reviewed articles on the topic. I'm also the author, as you mentioned, of the Architects of Dignity, Vietnamese Visions of Decolonization, published last month by Oxford University Press. And the book examines the ideas of six important Vietnamese figures. So in this series, we hope to explore some of those thinkers from my book, but also many other historical figures. So keep in mind, listener, that for some of these figures, other scholars have written articles and books that go into much more detail than we will go into. I'll try to refer to them, try to cite them where it's appropriate, and I apologize in advance if I forget to cite a relevant scholar. For each episode, we're not going to give a comprehensive, authoritative summary of the figure. That's just impossible. We cannot possibly capture the complexities of these figures, but what we can do is we're going to provide a modest, brief introduction to their lives and their ideas. So the goal is to give you a sense of who the person is, what historical background there is, what problems they were grappling with, and perhaps some suggestions for what we descendants of the Vietnamese can learn from them as we move forward. Just a few other things. So I'll try to rely on peer-reviewed scholarship as I do research on these figures in the English or French language scholarship, or the primary source writings of the figures we explore. I also do engage with Vietnamese sources, but this here is a bit more tricky because if you write in Vietnamese, in Vietnam, about national heroes or villains, there is an expected way of writing about them, a way that I think maybe is a little less critical towards the heroes and less sympathetic towards the villains, the perceived villains. So in Vietnam, the image of these figures, especially the heroes, is quite controlled, I would say. So my approach will be to be sympathetic and critical of these figures.
I appreciate you telling me the process of this. And you and I, when we first started a few weeks ago, we talked about the list of names. And one issue that I have, one problem that I think we're going to have is the balance of men and women historical figures, right? Because that's a big thing. We need to balance out. We need to round it out, make sure that we cover men and women of different periods. So that's going to be sort of an issue. We're going to do our best to include, you know, obviously we have the big ones like Hai Bajung and big figures, but it's still limited to, I would say, maybe 70-30, would you say, Kevin? I mean, we're lucky we get 30 in there in that number.
Yeah, and this is something that we need to think about, of course. Also, I mean, let's not hide around it. I mean, Vietnam, especially during the 20th century, was a patriarchal society. And simply put, women were often not allowed to be influential in the realm of politics and so on. But of course, women play a huge role. For example, in the Vietnamese decolonial movement, half of the Viet Minh who defeated the French at Dien Bien Phu were women. So we will have some women and we'll do our best. Yeah.
Yeah. But I just want everybody to know that we are very aware of it. And it's something that we've talked about, discussed, and we will do our best to kind of even it out if as best as we can. So I just wanted to bring attention to that issue.
Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
Phan Boi Cho. So, by the way, there's one more thing, a caveat. Not really a caveat, but listeners who know things about these figures, you might find something else significant that I didn't mention, so that's expected, and feel free to mention it in the comments. But Phan Boi Cho, I think it's perfect that we're starting with him. And the reason is because he is truly the pioneer of Vietnamese anti-colonial nationalism. In the early 20th century, he was Vietnam's best-known patriot in his resistance against French colonialism. So before we dive into Phan Boi Cho, we have to say something about the historical background. It's necessary. So I'm going to say a little bit about French colonialism. So because French colonialism doesn't just happen out of the blue. Okay, so some historical background. So by the 1850s, Europeans are having their eyes on Asia, and they are expanding their powers into Asia. Why? Because Napoleon is defeated in 1815, and the European major powers have signed treaties, so they're not going to fight each other in Europe, so they're going to flex their muscles in Asia. By the 1850s, Britain has control over India, Burma, Singapore, Malaya, and it also exerts its power in China. The Netherlands controls Java, and by then the Philippines were already part of the Spanish Empire for almost three centuries. So if France is going to maintain its glory, then it has to assert itself in Asia, many French officials think, right? So the leaders of France believe that the colonies will provide France with markets, human labor, natural resources like cotton, silk, sugar, rice, coffee, and rubber. Like when I teach my students about colonialism, I talk about how much I love desserts. You know, I love eating ice cream and stuff, but like these tastes are really linked to colonialism because they get all that sugar from the colonies and it changes the taste buds. Even coffee is changing Europe. You know, people didn't really drink coffee before. So the colonial history is really important here. So France wants to trade with the Far East, and it will need bases to fuel their ships. And they don't want to depend on the British for access to China through Singapore and Hong Kong. So French officials argued that Saigon can be France's Hong Kong, right? So something happens in 1857 that kind of triggers it all. The emperor at the time, his name is De Duc, and he had two European missionaries executed. This was part of a wave of persecutions of European missionaries. By the way, European Catholics had been coming to Vietnam for a very long time, much longer than that. And Vietnamese leaders, kings, they didn't really have a problem with them so much. But in this context of European imperialism, they are getting more worried about that. So anyway, two Europeans are executed. And then that year, in response, France and Spain, they send a fleet to punish the Vietnamese. So both France and Spain attack Da Nang, and they occupy the port town. That attack quickly becomes a colonial one. It's kind of the perfect excuse, right? So the French begin to conquer what becomes known as Indochina. And Indochina is today's Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. And it happens in stages, the conquest. So by the time Phan Boi Cho was born in 1867, the first stage is complete with the creation of the French colony in the south, Cochin China, Cochin Chine in French. So that's the south of Vietnam.
Can I stump you and ask you some questions? So this is 1859, you said, right? That they
1858 is when they attacked. Yeah.
So this is really the start of the invasion of France into Vietnam. This is the mark. This is when it all begins.
Exactly. 1858 is the date. You know, when I say French colonialism, usually I put 1858 to 1954. That's almost 100 years. But the thing is that, you know, you have to imagine it's an attack. So France did not control the whole place yet. But what happens is that after they create the colony of Cochin China in South Vietnam, the second stage ends around 1885 with the creation of Annam in the center and Tonkin in the north. So both of those, Annam and Tonkin, are technically under the authority of the Vietnamese imperial court, but under French protection. But by the late 1880s, really, we can say that French subjugation of all of today's Vietnam is complete. So they divide Vietnam into three sections. And so by the end of the 19th century, all countries in Southeast Asia, except for Siam, which is today called Thailand, they were under European colonial rule. So that's the context.
So I know that the missionaries were coming a lot. And there's a priest, I believe it was a Portuguese priest, that instituted the language. His name was Alexander Durant. I'm so not up on this history, but was that before 1858 or after 1858?
Absolutely, yes. So Alexandre de Rhodes, he came in, he's famous for creating basically the Quốc ngữ language, which is Romanized Vietnamese. So this is 17th century. This is the 1600s, way before the French come, way before. So what happens to the Quốc ngữ language? So he created it because he wanted it to be easier for European missionaries to learn the language, to speak to the people. Keep in mind that at the time, the official languages in Vietnam were classical Chinese and Vietnamese in Chinese characters. But Alexandre de Rhodes, he creates this Latin, Portuguese, Vietnamese dictionary. And that language, the Quốc ngữ, goes quiet until the French come. Now the French come and they pick it back up again. And they and so we'll talk more about Quốc ngữ. Yeah.
And thank you for responding to that question. I know it's kind of out of sequence, but the reason I bring it up is because how much of this sort of fertilizing do we have to do before these big ships come in and do their business, right? So I was always wondering, was it before like the invasions happen or after, where you know you establish a camp, you set up the colony, and then you send somebody to change the phonetics and the alphabets and all. So thank you for answering that.
Yeah. So let's turn to Phan Bội Châu here. Phan Bội Châu, as I had mentioned, was born in 1867 and he dies in 1940. So he lived for 73 years. He was born in Nghệ An province, which is in the north. And that's, by the way, which is where Ho Chi Minh was born. And when Phan Bội Châu was 9 years old, scholars in Nghệ An called for an armed uprising against the French. And he said in his autobiography, by the way, listeners can read that in English, by the way, it's called An Overturned Chariot. He said, "On hearing this, I assembled the children at my school using bamboo tubes for guns and lychee pits for bullets. We ourselves played at bintai, put down the French." So Phan Bội Châu was an anti-colonialist. He was also a Confucian. And at first, he was a monarchist. He believed in the king.
I want to ask, so when you say bintai, I think what I've read is that bin is to pacify. Tai is the French, right? So he actually had this idea at 9 years old to pacify the French at that moment.
Yeah. And of course, Tai just means a Westerner, right? So it's, they're just Europeans or foreigners. Right, exactly. So he's a young kid and he built his reputation as being passionate, always kind of wanting to use violence. And I'll talk about that in a bit more. But what's important to say here is that he changes throughout his life because he begins as a monarchist and eventually at the end of his life, he becomes a Republican. Now, I don't mean the political party in the United States. What I mean when political theorists talk about republicanism, what they mean is someone who is against monarchy and who believes that the people, not the king, should have ultimate authority. They should have sovereignty. So he changes. And another important point about Phan Bội Châu is that he was a self-admitted failure. He said, "I have failed." But what I want to suggest is that he has done a lot, actually. You know, he's not just a failure. He kind of creates the path for many after him. So through some attention to his personal journey and his writings, we can gain the best introduction to how the Vietnamese resisted colonialism early on. So Phan Bội Châu wanted to do something, but often he didn't really know what to do. He was just angry, right? So through him, the Vietnamese people are going to take their first steps towards learning about the Western world so that they can stand up to it. And another thing about Phan Bội Châu is he's kind of also constantly turning inward to his own people and shaming the Vietnamese. We talked about national shame last episode. He's shaming them for failing to stand up for themselves. So for example, I'm going to quote him here. He says, Those whom I blame most deeply are my people themselves. My deepest love is for my people, and my deepest blame is for my people. He even calls the Vietnamese barbaric. He says, barbarism is not using leaves as clothes to cover the body or catching snakes and centipedes as food. Rather, those who are dependent are barbaric. Weak people without self-reliance are barbaric. So he wants the Vietnamese to be self-reliant. Yeah. So I'm going to give a very brief bio here. I'm going to go really quickly just to get kind of a timeline of his life. Fenboy Cho studied Confucian texts under the guidance of his father, who was a Confucian scholar. Keep in mind, at this point, late 1800s, if you were a Vietnamese male, your goal was to do really well on the Confucian exams to become a Mandarin and work in government. That's what you strove for, right? So from 1885 to 1900, he studies for the exams. And after six attempts, he passes the regional exam in 1900, but he fails the highest level exam around 1903. But at the same time, around this time, he's also absorbing the ideas of European thinkers through Chinese translations. Keep in mind, he's reading and writing in Chinese. So from 1900 to 1905, Fenboy Cho travels around Vietnam, and he's just trying to gather support. He's especially talking to educated people, the bureaucracy, and he's basically saying, hey, you guys, we need to organize a resistance movement against the French. We had mentioned this in the last episode, but he was really inspired by Japan when they defeat Russia in 1905. So what does he do? He goes to Japan that year to learn from Japan and its reforms and to ask Japan for weapons. So he also coordinates a movement, we had mentioned this last episode, the Dongzhu, the Go East, right? To send Vietnamese students to study in Japan. And this is a turning point because there in Japan, he meets with someone who's going to change him. And that person is a Chinese reformer named Liang Qichao. Liang Qichao. And Liang Qichao advises Fenboy Cho to just write about Vietnam's situation. Fenboy Cho is like, what should we do? And Liang Qichao is like, first, you need to tell your people that the French are abusing your country. You need to promote a sense of national consciousness. So Liang Qichao says, okay, write about it. And by the way, Fenboy Cho meets with Fan Chu Chin, and together they visit schools in Japan, and then they inspire the creation of the Dongking Yetok in Hanoi in 1907. So anyway, in 1908, Japan agrees with France to disband the Dongzhu movement to stop it. And so now Fenboy Cho is expelled from Japan because the country is no longer open to the Vietnamese. And Fenboy Cho goes to South China to contact Chinese revolutionaries. And over there, he buys weapons with money sent from Vietnam, and he tries to find a way to smuggle the weapons to Vietnam, but he doesn't succeed. So he donates the weapons to Sun Yat-sen's Revolutionary Party. And then in 1911, of course, the Chinese have a revolution. It's a Republican revolution. And Fenboy Cho starts thinking about creating an Asian alliance against European powers. From 1912 to 1925, Fenboy Cho's he's in China. And in 1914, he's arrested and imprisoned by a Chinese ruler because the ruler thinks that Fenboy Cho is mixing with the ruler's enemies. Anyway, Fenboy Cho gains his freedom in 1917. And then from then until 1925, he tries to reach out to other foreigners, even the Germans at the time. And for a time, he even considered working with this French Governor General, Albert Sarraut, who was a progressive. But anyway, after the First World War, so this is 1918, Fenboy Cho, he kind of goes into the background. He becomes a much more passive figure after 1918. He's not as influential anymore. So his glory days were the early 1900s. Now, I'm almost done with that bio here. I'm almost done. In 1925, he's again arrested in China. And there's some controversy here because some people say that Ho Chi Minh was there at the time and he turned Fenboy Cho into the French in exchange for some money. But some scholars are going to dispute this and they're going to say, actually, the story was invented by anti-Ho Chi Minh propaganda, But anyway, Phan Boi Châu is arrested. He gets brought back to Hanoi. He's put under a house arrest in Hue, and that's basically the end of his years. By the way, in Hue, he was friends with, guess who? Ngô Đình Diệm, first president of South Vietnam from 1933 until 1940, which is the year he died. All right, so that's a really quick biography.
You know, there's a few ironies here that I find, which is the first one is this person goes to Japan to seek help. But a few decades later, Japan brings and just really creates havoc in the north. And as a result, famine arises and famine happens as a result of the Japanese trying to take over the region and trying to fight back the French. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, Japan, they were having imperialist expansions as well. You know, they tried to represent the Asians in this fight against the Europeans. And in the early stages, this is looking attractive to Phan Boi Châu.
But it didn't turn out well for the Vietnamese people because of what the Japanese did, right? I mean, as I understand it, they really took all the grain sources, the rice, and just put it into storage, and they just guarded it. And then basically millions of people in the north died as a result of that.
Yeah, and you know, when we get to the episode on Ngô Đình Diệm, there are different reactions actually to the Japanese, because of course, Ho Chi Minh is going to hate the Japanese occupation and the French occupation. France and Japan occupy Vietnam at the same time. So it's Japan who has the main authority while they let the French do the day-to-day governance and so on. But Ngô Đình Diệm, you know, he might see an opportunity here that maybe they can team up against the French. You know, so there are different reactions to the Japanese.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And another question I had while you're going over the biography is a simple thing like communication and money to sponsor your state travels and going overseas and, you know, mingling and rubbing elbows with all these different contacts. I mean, you have to be funded somehow. And how does the communication, which makes me think about money, and it makes me think about, like, how is your network set up in those years, in the early years, to do this if you're really just a broke intellectual?
Yeah. So that's why I had mentioned earlier, when he was going around Vietnam in the early 1900s, he's connecting with educated, with elite people, with the bureaucracy. He's trying to get money, trying to get funding for these things, for this study abroad program. Keep in mind that at this time, as I had mentioned, all these young Vietnamese men are trying to get an official career in government. But for him, what's more urgent is to liberate Vietnam from colonial rule. In 1901, his father dies. And for him, this kind of presents an opportunity, because now he can devote himself to this anti-colonial project. So he says, I'm going to quote him here. He says, after his father died, he says, "The heavy charge of my family fell away and my shoulders were lightened. Thus, I began to set about my revolutionary plans." And his plans were simple and straightforward. He just thought that you needed a mass violent uprising and that this would kind of spark a more national widespread uprising. So what does he do? He plans to travel around Vietnam to contact the remnants of the failed Gan Vuong movement. So the Gan Vuong movement, the Save the King movement, this was when in 1885, the Emperor Ham Nghi, he urges scholars to mobilize for war against the French to restore independence. So that movement failed, and Phan Boi Châu wants to get back in touch with these patriots and to mobilize them for another military uprising. And then he's going to send Vietnamese abroad to try to get weapons. And he says, "The aim of these plans," and I'm quoting, "was exclusively to restore Vietnam and to establish an independent government. Apart from this, there was as yet no other idea." So in a sense, he's kind of simple minded, if I could put it that way. You know, he just wants to get rid of the French. In 1904, he thinks that you just need a spark. But at the same time, he's getting annoyed and critical of the Vietnamese imperial court and the Mandarins. He thinks they're incompetent and immoral, and he begins to recognize the shortcomings of monarchy. And he begins to find more attractive these modern ideas of popular sovereignty and republicanism. So eventually he realizes that, okay, it's not enough just to kick out the French with violence. Vietnam actually needs to change its ideas. It needs to modernize. And that's just as important as overthrowing the French.
But when he has this idea of overthrowing the French through violence, who can get behind this? Because you kind of have to have the capital to go to war against a superpower that invades you.
Yeah. And in his early writings here, so remember, Liang Qichao says, write things for the Vietnamese. In those writings, one of his main goals is to get people angry. He's saying the French are doing this. They are violating our people. They are abusing us. And he's trying to make them indignant so that they will get violent. But what happens is that he begins to realize, okay, that's not enough. And so he gathers young Vietnamese into what becomes known as the Vietnam Modernization Society, Vietnam Duy Tân Hội. So innovation, the Vietnamese need to innovate. And it's focused on socioeconomic reforms. So this organization's more progressive than the Gan Vung royalist movement, and because they prioritize education. And that's why he sends Vietnamese to Japan. Now, in Japan, I had mentioned Liang Qichao, and Liang says that, you know what, Phan Boi Châu, you should not rely on the Japanese for military aid. And you need to really focus on reforming Vietnamese minds before violently resisting colonizers. He says, Liang Qichao says, your country should not be concerned about not having a day of independence, but should be concerned about not having an independence-minded people. So basically, the Vietnamese need to be ready in their mind for independence. Yeah.
That's a great point to differentiate the two.
Yeah. It's funny, when Liang says that to Phan Boi Châu, he writes, in that moment, the horizons of my consciousness and vision suddenly broadened. I became painfully aware that up to that time, my ideas and my actions had all been thoughtless and imprudent. Thereupon, I began to write the book, Vietnam Vong Quoc Su, The History of the Loss of Vietnam. So this is a very famous little book. And the book criticizes Vietnamese emperors for failing to reform the country. It celebrates the Gan Vung heroes. It describes the evils of French colonialism. So Phan Boi Châu wrote his text in classical Chinese, but he had it recopied and translated to Quốc ngữ, which then people took secretly and spread it around, and they read it out loud to villagers. So he would go on and write more stuff like this.
It's incredible what one man can do during that time.
Really? I'm telling you, it's the writing, you know, it's the ideas that are so important here. And so one other thing that he's trying to get across in these writings is the necessity of unity. I'm going to quote him again. Unity can protect the country. Failure to agree with each other will lead to the destruction of the country. If you don't agree with your people, you'll eventually be enslaved by others.
Wow.
So solidarity is a necessary condition, right, for dignity, for national dignity. He says, I'm going to quote him again, divided strength is weakness. A divided heart is a broken heart. If we are isolated and they are united, then they will always win and we will always fail. A handful of chopsticks is difficult to break, but it's easy to break one piece at a time. That's obvious. Isn't that amazing? You could perfectly understand, you know, with the chopsticks.
Yeah, and it, you know, as you were talking about all of this, I'm probably going to go back to this one question quite often in our episodes, is how is this figure looked at in the Vietnamese diaspora community, and how is this figure looked at it within Vietnam?
I mean, that's a great question. We can just ask people in the diaspora, do you know who Phan Boi Châu is, and what do you think? I asked my aunts and uncles, and they tell me, yeah, we study Phan Boi Châu, but I get him mixed up with Phan Chu Trinh. I don't really know what his ideas were.
You know? Yeah.
So I would really urge all Vietnamese to read these writings. Like, there's another really interesting text called The New Vietnam that he writes in 1907. And I think this one is so interesting because he starts by just describing the country. And he says, the area of our country is 250,000 square miles. Isn't that spacious? Our country's population has more than 50 million people. Isn't that a lot? The land is fertile. Our mountains and rivers are beautiful. Compared with the strongest countries in the other five continents, our land is not inferior. So why should we submit to the protection of France? And then he criticizes the Vietnamese because he says they were slaves to the Chinese. He says, our slave mentality is deep-rooted. Our habit of dependence is heavy. Right? So he's trying to build this national consciousness that just didn't exist at the time. And another thing, I don't know if we had mentioned in previous episodes, but the Vietnamese were colonizers too, you know, that they start from the north and they are conquering the Cham and the Khmer peoples as they move southward from around the 15th century and onward. And he says, without the heroic efforts of the Vietnamese people, Vietnam would just be the land of Champa, Laos, and Cambodia. So he's kind of like, look, we used to be great colonizers too. And it's thanks to our ancestors who gave us this land. So why are we allowing foreigners to take it?
Well, very fascinating history. You know, and I go back to thinking, you know, one major contribution that he really we could attribute to is the formation of the idea of like, let's get the invaders, just let's get them out. That's really the crux of what he's going through, right?
Well, that's half of it. That's half of it. But remember, he's beginning to realize that's not enough. And so he is going to say, it's not enough to get rid of them. We need to change how we think. Number one, we need to become patriots. And number two, we need to rethink what kind of political system we need. Like, should we still have a king or should we have something else? Are the people ready for a democracy or what should that look like, you know? And in this, he's not as sophisticated as Phan Chu Trinh. Phan Chu Trinh was much more interested in ideas. But what Phan Boi Cho does is he kind of gets the ball rolling. You know, he's really the first to be exposed to ideas of the French Enlightenment thinkers. But again, he doesn't read French. So it's not until younger generations later. But what he does do is he's good at getting the people angry. Can I just read one more quote, which I love right here? These are Phan Boi Cho's words, you know, so I will use the softer version. So he says, behold, those people with blue eyes and pink beards, they are not our fathers, nor our brothers. They are not our teachers. How can they squat here, pooping and peeing on our heads? Are you men not ashamed, humiliated, or resentful enough to kill these invaders?
Right. How is he not put to death right away by the French?
I'm so glad this is a perfect segue. Because what happens is, again, in 1925, he's arrested by the French and he's put on trial on charges of incitement to murder and supplying weapons that were used to kill a Vietnamese governor and two French majors. And so he's put on trial. And at his trial, he gives his very last famous speech, and in this speech, he summarizes his life's patriotic efforts. Am I reading too many quotes here?
No. This is very important.
I think it's good for listeners to hear from, you know, Phan Boi Cho himself.
Yeah, it's very important so we can get the context of how you're moving along in the in this episode.
Right. So this is a little more lengthy, but I think it's an important one. This is his last famous speech, right? So he says, if we had a few hundred thousand sailors, a few tens of thousands of soldiers armed with many guns, warships, and airplanes, then I would submit my declaration of war and righteously resist the colonial government. But I'm merely a student. My pockets are empty of money. I have no weapons. I cannot engage in armed resistance. Therefore, I've only sought to use culture, which is to say, I try to mobilize the people to demand political reforms. My work is merely to use my tongue and my pen, and my goal is political reform. The movement I lead is simple and righteous. If I've done wrong, my only sins are the following. Number one, even though no one else opposed the colonial government, I alone resisted because I wanted the country to be independent. Two, the country formerly had an absolute monarchy, but I wanted it to become a republic. Three, the colonial state banned people from traveling overseas for study, but I fled and recruited students to go to foreign countries to study. And four, I tried to mobilize and awaken the people of the country of the South, which is Vietnam, to demand that the government institute political reforms to complete its mandate to bring enlightenment to the country. Wow. This speech, I mean, you see so many things in this speech, right? You have to imagine that he's speaking to the French government, and he's basically saying, like, look, I just wanted you to be better colonizers. I wanted you to actually educate and enlighten our people, but instead, you're not. And I'm not being violent. I just wanted to reform the minds of the Vietnamese. You know, so here we see him changing, actually. At first, he tried to resist colonialism with violence and then with culture. And before it was royalist ideology, the monarchy, and now it's republicanism. Right? So what happens is the speech evokes public outcry for Phan Boi Châu. And the French know that Phan Boi Châu is famous. They know he's a hero to young Vietnamese. So what do? They avoid making a martyr out of him. Like, they don't want to kill him because that'll make things really tougher for the French. So they send him to Hue to live in solitude for the rest of his life, basically.
And how old was he when he was locked up on house arrest?
Yeah, so this is 1925. Okay, I can't do the math right here. He was born in 1867.
25, so what is that?
30.
So it's 58, roughly?
Yeah. I mean, he's at the end of his days, you know, and he really then just kind of drops out of the picture, really, at, you know, from 1918 onwards, you know. But still, he's really famous. I mean, Ken, did you grow up hearing this name, Phan Boi Châu?
No, I just started hearing about him as I got into the podcast work.
Ever wonder what makes pandas so special? Join us on Amazing Wildlife to find out.
Giant pandas and their habitat are unique and beautiful and extraordinary representation of the natural world. And if you get that opportunity to sit and watch a panda eat bamboo, you will be mesmerized.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Amazing Wildlife and start listening.
Yeah, who's teaching this? You know, who's teaching any of this stuff? But see, that's why I'm raising sort of a little bit of the awareness, but also the skepticism, the worry that are we listening to propaganda from either side? Because I want this space to be full of propaganda, that we are aware that it's propaganda, and I want it to be free of propaganda, the propaganda that we don't know is propaganda, right? I want it to be a fair and balanced, safe space where we can talk about these things.
The best way to learn, I tell my students, is to try to engage as much different propaganda as you can. Be multi-biased, be 360 degrees, look at an issue from as many different propagandistic sides as possible.
Because let's be honest, I can hear sort of like his history and I can be like, oh, this is probably the roots of the early Viet Minh movement, right? This is the godfather, could be looked at that way by the Viet diaspora in the West. Like, this could be the early father of, let's band together and kick out the quote-unquote invaders. And invaders could be the French, the Japanese, and the U.S.
You know what? I also forgot to mention, Phan Boi Châu was friends, allegedly, with Ho Chi Minh's father. There are stories, and I'm drawing on the book by William Diker. He wrote a biography of Ho Chi Minh's life. But William Diker says that Phan Boi Châu and Ho Chi Minh's father would hang out at home, and little Ho Chi Minh would bring them tea, you know, in the living room. And Ho Chi Minh would listen to Fanboy Cho and get inspired.
Is that real or is that all anecdotal?
You know, I mean, you'll have to look in the where William Diker gets his sources, but that's in that book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, go ahead.
Well, one other thing I wanted to mention is that if people do learn about Fanboy Cho, typically they learn about him next to Fan Chuqin, and there's sort of the stereotype that, oh, Fanboy Cho was the revolutionary and Fan Chuqin was the reformer. But if you look closer at the writings of these figures, it's actually much more complicated than that, because Fanboy Cho was not just interested in violence. And even if he was kind of a conservative revolutionary, which is an oxymoron, of course, which is, you know, if you try to kick out the French just to replace the king, that's not a revolution. That's anti-colonialism, that's resistance, but it's not revolution in changing the society and their ways of governing and so on.
So the difference between a revolutionary and a reformer is just that, right? A revolutionary is you're going to go in and actively, by all means, violence, whatever it takes, to overthrow the current mode of government. And a reformer is just there to change things?
No. So a revolution is using violence to overthrow the government, but having a vision of creating a new society. That's really important. You need a vision to create a new society. A reformer is someone who prefers to use gradual means and not rather than violence. And it's true that Fan Chuqin was much less in favor of violence than Fanboy Cho. Fanboy Cho was definitely much more in favor of violence, for sure.
So I want to ask about the next stage of our episode, which is, what did Fanboy Cho do for the future of Vietnam? What do you think was his biggest contribution to the future of Vietnam after his passing?
Yeah. So I've already gone through a lot about his life and history, but there are a few important things that he does. Number one is he literally creates a sense of nationalism. Nationalism is just the idea that you belong to a people. And he understood that back then, the Vietnamese people did not see themselves as a Vietnamese people.
Wow.
Like they just cared about their village life, or they just maybe knew that they were subjects to a king, but they didn't have a sense that they belonged to a country. It wasn't until 1907 at the Dong Kinh Nghĩa Thuc, the school that he helped inspire, that you, for the first time, the Vietnamese people in these villages could see a map of Vietnam. You know, it's their first time seeing their country, right? So in his writings, you see in real time, he's literally creating this idea of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And by the way, we have to remember that the name Vietnam does not come into use until 1945.
Right, and the flags too. There's a transition of all of these different flags that were happening, right?
Right. I mean, the name Vietnam really comes into use in 1802 with that emperor, name's blanking on me right now, the emperor in 1802 who unifies all of Vietnam. And that's only for about 10 years or so. And then it's called like Dai Viet and Dai Nam. And then you have all these other Vietnams. But anyway, your question was, what did he do for Vietnam? Number one, he generates this nationalism, which is crucial because all the other thinkers, keep in mind, I told you, Ngo Dinh Diem was a friend and great admirer of Fanboy Cho. And Ho Chi Minh admires Fanboy Cho, right? So he's going to get it all started.
You know what makes me think? I think about who in the world today is living amongst us in history. I mean, obviously, that's not an answer that we're going to answer right now. But can you imagine that the young Fanboy Cho is living somewhere and coming up with all these political ideologies to change the world, whether it's in Vietnam or elsewhere, that will affect the country of Vietnam effectively, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, you say coming up with ideologies, but really it was him searching for an ideology. And he knows that he won't find it in Vietnam. That's why he goes to Japan. Here's an interesting thing about all revolutions everywhere in the world. No revolutionary thought has ever been indigenous.
So nothing.
Isn't that crazy?
Or indigenous or original coming from
China. You know, think about all the revolutions. Think about Mao Zedong. Where did he get his ideas? A German dude, Karl Marx. Where did the Russians get their revolutionary ideas? A German dude, Karl Marx and Engels, you know. Where did the French revolutionaries get from? English liberalism and Genevan republicanism, you know, so all these revolutionaries, they get these ideas from the outside. So he knows that he has to go and travel to get help.
So are you saying if anything happens in Vietnam, it's coming from the outside?
But that's with every revolution in the world. I mean, if a listener can tell me one revolution, and by revolution, I mean a radical change, a vision for a radical change in a society in terms of political relationships, like where do they get those ideas? They often come from somewhere from the outside. And it's often the educated people who travel and read other ideas from abroad.
So you did sort of answer this question probably in many different ways, but how do you think the Vietnamese diaspora views Phan Bội Châu, and how do you think Vietnam's people think of Phan Bội Châu?
I can say pretty confidently, I think that in Vietnam today, the Vietnamese people see him as a great patriot and they admire him. Absolutely. I mean, there are names of on street signs, Phan Bội Châu, right? And my guess is that Vietnamese in the diaspora probably see him as a patriot. You know, this is before. He is active way before communism comes to Vietnam. Communism does not become a predominant ideology in the north of Vietnam or Vietnam until the 1930s, and it trickles in the 1920s. But Phan Bội Châu is all before that. So I think they would see him as a patriot.
Yeah, that's good to know. It's really good to know. Because there's some, I think there's some characters that we will be discussing that leans heavily one way or the other. And I, you know, I'm here to talk about, and I think you are too, the merits and the, you know, the faults and the stains of it all, right? Like, we want to talk about this openly, and, you know, but the only way to do it is to ask these very raw and naked questions to you.
Right, right. You know, that there is, by the way, William Dyker is someone who has written a lot about Phan Bội Châu, and you could find articles on this. But William Dyker mentions that later in Phan Bội Châu's life, so, you know, he's under house arrest in Hue, and he actually just starts writing about Confucian morality and Confucian philosophy. But he also becomes interested in socialism for a little bit, I guess. But I think with Phan Bội Châu, he's still not really sure what political ideologies are. You know, what he prefers.
You know, I was listening to a podcast this morning, and it was talking about, they were basically giving justification to why the U.S. is right, right? Like, and then I was thinking about, where do I fit? Where does Kevin fit in this conversation? If there were things that were immoral throughout the history of Vietnam, and, you know, these colonizers came in and they cleaned things up for us and they made it better, where do we, as, you know, as you, as a historian, draw the line and say, but things like, you know, things culturally where it's uncomfortable and unbearable, where do we see it? And where do you draw the line to what's acceptable as the French is going in and they're, you know, cleaning up, or they're turning savages into civilization?
I see. So is what you're saying that, what I'm hearing is you're saying that the U.S. troops in Afghanistan, they saw these sort of barbaric, backwards cultural things that the Afghans were doing, and therefore that justifies U.S. Presence or U.S. civilizing or something like that?
Correct. Exactly.
Okay.
And in the history of Vietnam, I'm sure that exists. Whether it's like eating dogs or, you know, something that simple, but like it's completely unacceptable to people in the West today in modern history.
Yeah. So one justification that colonizers tend to use is that they have a superior civilization and that those that they're colonizing are backwards, inferior, etc. Keep in mind that the Vietnamese were using the same logic when they were conquering and colonizing the Cham and the Khmer. The Vietnamese saw themselves as part of a superior Han civilization. They kind of saw themselves as Chinese as they were conquering the Cham and the Khmer, you know, this more superior Confucian civilization. Wow. The French come in and they are going to certainly see the Vietnamese as backwards and so on. And you have... But what gets very interesting is that, for example, the French are going to try to build railroads. And in doing so, they're going to rip apart these ancestral lands of Vietnamese people. They're just going to dig up graves and stuff. And many Vietnamese at this time were also into geomancy, you know, like looking at... I guess, how would you define geomancy? But there's a kind of mystical power in the formation, you know, your environment, and it matters where things are placed and so on. And so they have sort of what we would call superstitions, basically.
Or feng shui, right?
Yeah, feng shui, basically. And what's interesting is that you also have Vietnamese reformers who are also saying that the Vietnamese need to stop thinking about this stuff. So they almost sound like French colonizers because they're saying, like, come on, Vietnamese people, we need to learn about science and not rely on superstition. So they sound sort of like colonizers, but they're doing it to strengthen the Vietnamese to stand up to French colonialism.
Yeah. And this is a debate in my mind all the time. It's like, at what point do the colonial powers have a right to say, hey, we need to clean this up and you guys are savages? Or at what point did somebody like Alexander de Roth come in and really do a service? He did a solid for the Vietnamese people by anglifying the phonetics of the language of Vietnam. And I think a big reason why the high literacy rate in Vietnam exists is because of the romanized alphabet of going from Han to Quốc Việt, right?
Yeah. Actual colonialism has complex effects, of course. So I don't think it's useful to say, like, this is 100% bad and nothing ever good came out of it, but we do have to be very sensitive to the humiliation and the hurt and pain that many Vietnamese suffered under French humiliation and domination. You know, colonialism is an unequal, non-reciprocal domination relationship. And it's true that, you know, we can look back and say, oh, here were good things and here were bad things. And, you know, I don't think that it justifies this kind of domination. I am someone who is personally against when humans dominate others, you know, and I don't think that that should be done in the name of something else. But to be honest, this is a very lively debate in the field, especially of just war theory. The question is, I mean, you were in the
Marines.
You were in the Marines, yeah. So the question is when is it okay to intervene, right? When is it okay to intervene in some other country? If they are killing their own people, when is it okay? You know, and so at what point? But often it becomes a justification for other motives, such as labor exploitation, resources, etc.
Yeah. Well, I would love to, I mean, we're at the end of the episode. Do you have any closing thoughts? Do you want to kind of bring up more ideas that Phan Bui Châu brought?
You know, I wanted to ask the young Vietnamese, or it doesn't have to be young, but what lessons did they think that they can get from Phan Bui Châu? And, you know, I was wondering if I should go here, what I'm about to say next, but since we're talking about the things that are affecting us in our lives these days, last night I went to a film festival in Amsterdam. It's a documentary film festival. And the documentary I watched was called No Other Land. and it's about what's happening in Palestine. And this documentary follows this young Palestinian man in the West Bank with his friend who is an Israeli. And both of them together, they are trying to record and document Israeli soldiers who are demolishing homes and schools. And the whole evening, you know who I was thinking about? Fanboy Joe, man, because I knew we had this episode. And for that young Palestinian, I couldn't help but think, well, he is, you know, basically, that's what Fanboy Cho was feeling. You feel so helpless. What do you do? You know, Fanboy Cho lived in early 1900 where he was able to go off into Japan. Young Palestinians, they cannot move.
Yeah.
You know, they cannot get out. And so what lesson I took from Fanboy Cho is that the question that someone who is living under oppression, the question for them is, what do I do with my indignation? What do I do with it? You know, what do I do? Where do I direct my energy? And for Fanboy Joe, he had to experiment, and he tried a lot of different ways.
Well, I think that's a great question to leave the audience with. Is when we are faced with indignation, how do we respond? And leave it in the comments. We'd love to hear from you. Kevin, thank you so much. Could we tease the next episode? Who are we going to be talking about?
Yeah. So go ahead. Who are we talking about,
Kevin? Well, I think there was a debate if it was going to be a woman or the next person on the list. But I was thinking about Mao Dai, which is the last emperor of Vietnam, and he is a sad, almost pathetic figure that almost symbolizes the end of that era of the monarch. There was even debate of, was he really the last person in a monarchy, because that thing fell apart probably way before he was put into that position.
Yeah, I think that's a great teaser for the next episode.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Ever wonder what makes pandas so special? Join us on Amazing Wildlife to find out.
Giant pandas and their habitat are unique and beautiful and extraordinary representation of the natural world. And if you get that opportunity to sit and watch a panda eat bamboo, you will be mesmerized.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Amazing Wildlife and start listening.